Judges chapter 1. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, Come up with me to my allotted territory, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory. And Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adoni Bezek in Bezek, and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adoni Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Then Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table, as I have done, so God has repaid me. Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who dwelt in the mountains, in the south, and in the lowland. Then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. And they killed Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. Then Caleb said, Whoever attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Achsah as wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Achsah as wife. Now it happened, when she came to him, that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, What do you wish? So she said to him, Give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Now the children of Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of palms with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. And Judah went with his brother Simeon. And they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Also, Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland, because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. 22. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy. So he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword. But they let the man and all his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. For the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites, who dwelt in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Alab, Akzib, Helba, Aphek, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shalbim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. Well, I'll go with instruction in a minute. First of all, are there any questions about the book of Judges that I could answer quickly off the top before we begin too deep into this? Anything that caught your attention? Questions? Something like, well, what's up with that?
Well, this is, I guess, this discussion here about how they weren't doing their jobs and how they just decided to take the easier route of putting them under tribute.
That's very true. That's pretty much some of the book of Judges in a nutshell.
They were simulating the movement to their...
Assimilating, yes.
Well, it's really funny because under chapter 1, it says failure of Judah in my margin. Inspired margin. Failure of Benjamin, failure of Joseph, Zebulun, Asher, and Naphtali. Looks to me like Judah succeeded. They went through, they erased this, they erased that, they took over and they ran them off.
Mm-hmm. With the exception of certain territories. Yes, Bill. Hold on a second. Territories in the valley, they were unable to do it. Yes, Bill.
This kind of directed to Richard. He and I were talking in here. Is that a commandment, Richard?
Is that
a commandment? What chapter? I mean, verse 2.
Is verse 2?
Yahweh said, Judah shall go up.
Yeah. Oh.
Is that a commandment? Or
yes.
That's a command.
That would be, yeah, because he commanded them to do so.
The statute, what?
It's not there yet.
I'll leave that for a private conversation. But yes, there's a difference between statutes and commandments. This happened to be a commandment. It was not a statute. Statute is a continual thing. Commandment in this particular case is a never-ending. It's similar to statutes, but statutes are more of rulings and judgments. Commandments are, hey, you will go do this until you're done doing it. We have the Ten Commandments, which, of course, we don't stop doing those until we're dead. Some argue we still do them afterward, but that's a theological debate. This commandment is for Judah to go up first, which we're going to get into a little bit of, bias. Well, yeah, we use the word bias. In this particular book, that's heavily biased toward the tribe of Judah, and we'll discuss why in a minute. This is a commandment that he commanded them to do their task until a task is completed.
And they didn't do it.
They didn't complete it, no. Okay.
That'd be kind of like not getting sin out of your life like you're supposed to. It's kind of performed.
Very much so. It's almost an identical parallel to not... We, in our own personal struggles, we are given certain things to do, and it's usually associated with our lives, how we live, the laws that we are to obey, the spirit behind those laws. All those are given to each of us. Some of us struggle with one law or another, but we're all given the same set to work with. If we choose not to work with that set or say, oh, well, I'll select this group, but this one that's really hard for me, I'm going to ignore, that's almost identical to what's happening symbolically with each of the tribes. They're given their task is this territory is a gift from God. You are to do and control this territory. And they said, okay, we'll control up to this point, but now it's just too much work. I can't handle the last bit, so I'm going to not go there. I'm just not going to do it. I'll ignore it.
So then they have to suffer consequences.
They have to suffer all the consequences, right. Which is actually listed in Judges chapter 2. Discusses some of the consequences that they're going to suffer, which we're not going to go there today. That's in 2 weeks. Yes, Tammy?
If you actually think about the map, you can definitely see where those consequences went far beyond the lifetime of any of these judges. It goes even into later on when King David, and even
continues.
After that, you're seeing the seeds of it.
Still
in
there.
In this very chapter, you see the seeds of those consequences.
They stay.
All the way through their history until the exile.
They stay. Really. Exactly. It's a permanent thing. I mean, once you've made a decision not to follow, that's it. All right, there is no second chance type of design. It wasn't designed that way.
Eventually lead to their total downfall.
Yeah.
Because they contaminated their
exactly.
They contaminated their whole society.
Exactly. It does lead to downfall. That's correct. It actually starts during Joshua's lifetime, which means they didn't live very long without, you know, from the point where Moses said, okay, now you're all perfect, go into the land. It lasted for maybe about a year or so, and then they all went downhill. It didn't last a long time. It was a short period of time, but they just couldn't hack it. And no fault of their own, they're human beings. And we all are.
We
do the best we can, and there are going to be days or even hours during the day we're going to screw up. That's the nature. You had your hand up, Shagan?
This thing with Judah is just kind of interesting to me, I guess.
Yeah.
Because in verse 2, God says, I've delivered the land into his hand. And then in verse 19, it says the Lord was with Judah. And then at the end of that verse, it says they couldn't drive out the ones in the valley because they had chariots of iron. It doesn't say that they didn't try to or that they got tired of it. It doesn't say mm-hmm. they put them under tribute. It doesn't say any of that. It says,
right.
First, I'm going to help you get rid of all these people. And then it says they couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it. Right.
That
right.
Mm-hmm.
We've entered a new era with the Book of Judges.
Yes.
All right. This is not, I realize we just covered Joshua a couple of weeks ago, but don't carry the thought process that was in the Book of Joshua and carry it over to the Judges in the next 400 years. It doesn't work. There are a couple of reasons. Number one, different authors. Joshua and some people of his own contemporaries wrote his book and the stories around it. It wasn't compiled into a book till generations later, but the stories were written then. The book of Judges and the stories around the Judges was written by one particular individual, the one who was the most prolific author of all the Judges, which is Samuel. He wrote it. He had all the little stories compiled. He lived 400 years later. So the mentality and the hindsight and thought process and the consequences of actions in Joshua's book are conjecture. They're thinking, well, this could happen to you in the future. Well, in Samuel's time, says, look what happened to you. It's past tense. So you have a lot more detail in the consequences, while Joshua's book is more looking to the future as hope. Samuel looks at the book of Judges as disgrace. And the hope didn't work. Samuel looks at it more as what Moses warned about in the book of Deuteronomy. This isn't so good. You guys didn't do such a good job. It does not specifically say that that Judah did not attempt to control or conquer the lowlands. You're absolutely right. It does not say that. It is implied that as they grew stronger, they still didn't do it. Which actually did happen over the next 400 years. They didn't do squat until David shows up on the scene and he finally does it 400 years later. They had the opportunity. They opted to not take it. That's the key, what Samuel gets after. I hope that answers your question a little bit. I don't know if it's that clearly or not, or your comment,
yeah,
I should say.
I mean, who wrote the book?
Right. It has a lot to do with that. I mean, keep in mind, we're going to a little bit of... Okay, hold on. Before I go too deep in this, I need to do my little introduction. All right. okay, we already discussed before, with the death of Joshua and the death of Moses, we have no leaders left, right? They're all gone. Who's left? Well, Caleb's old. He's going downhill real fast. Which, granted, is a contemporary, but he's going down. He wasn't around life for too many years after Joshua died.
No prime.
Yeah, there was no say, oh, hey, you've been working with, Joshua talks to him, you've been working with him for so many years, you are now the national leader. That's gone. Now we have a system of judges showing up, and judges a shofa team. It's just a process of, we would, in modern day language, use the term warlord. That's what we call them. Maybe they'd be warlords. Now, we think of warlords as negative today. Well, no, that's not quite how you necessarily would look at a warlord back then. Warlords are more of doing their job.
A chief.
Yeah, somebody's in charge. Sometimes they go to battle. Sometimes they're in civil jobs. But there's still that function. They're still doing that task. So we're moving from one concept and whole government structure to a whole new one. When Joshua died. And this was a big thing with Joshua. That's why we spent a couple weeks ago, the last couple chapters of Joshua, him telling them, hey, you guys got to get this together. You have to take care of this because there is nobody else. But God's still going to be with you. That was Joshua's continual theme the last two books, or last chapters. He was saying, God's still there. God's still with you. So we have a whole new system. They have no normal leader. They do have court systems. They have basic instructions that the Torah gave. So they have, for the most part, they follow all that. There's a general thought growing in them that God's supposed to be their leader. That really doesn't sink in for a long time. But they have that general idea. Meaning the citizens do. At this point, the tribes and Book of Judges are occupied with one task. That is to conquer their territory. The Book of Judges and the Book of Joshua overlap by quite a few years. Meaning the first part of the Book of Judges, a lot of the same stories and information is also in Book of Joshua. There are twists that show up. We are, by moving into this book, we are seeing the division that happens between Judah and Ephraim.
Okay.
We just witnessed, saw part of it already in reading this first chapter. The division we always associate, well, it's the kings that did it. It's Solomon that did it, right? It's the Rehoboam and the Jeroboams, all the other Boams that are out there. They're the ones who did it. They're the kings. They're all at fault. Well, no. God had this thing set up and planned the moment Moses died. The moment Joshua took over, this division was started. And it just grew the next 400 years. It got bigger. We have stories of the same battles in Joshua discussed in the Book of Judges with different outcomes.
Some of those battles also listed numbers.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Some of them are actually listed numbers too. Also, different outcomes. Well, how's that possible? And different people fought them. Well, that doesn't make any sense. We just like, for example, Jerusalem. Well, it's taken. Joshua took it once already. According to the Book of Joshua, Judah takes it, correction, tries to take it later during the Book of Joshua and failed. And now we have the Book of Judges, Judah takes it and succeeds, but Benjamin fails. So four different things happening with the same town. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Same time?
Yeah, they're all based at the same time, give or take a couple of years. They're all the same time. There are a couple of differences, but not a whole lot. So, and this isn't just the only instance. It happens a couple of towns are this way. Well, you got to be, this division is happening. And we think of division of, oh, well, Ephraim's up there, well, up here, a little map, and Judah's down here. We think of division of as territory, right? And division in concept of rule and who controls what was also a division of history. Whoever wins gets to write the history books, right? We all know that. That's the nature of all wars, battles, everything else. The winner writes the history book, and they always write it in their own personal favor. Samuel's writing the Book of Judges. At the time when he's writing this, what's going on in his lifetime? What's happening? David and Saul are fighting. Samuel doesn't like Saul at this point. He hasn't liked him all along. We already know that. By the way, Samuel writes this somewhere around 1 Samuel from chapter 11 on through to chapter 20, or something, 20 something. In that ballpark of time frame is when he's compiling the story in the book of Judges. He's not the perfect author. He's no different than any other human being. But these are all the stories that every tribe has, and he's gathering it together. Say, hey, we can't lose this data. He's gathering it into what we call Book of Judges. There are some that he has minimal knowledge of. Like, we'll read across them. Hey, so-and-so judged Israel for 10 years, and he died. Well, that person obviously was not the author of the Book of Judges, because they're not going to sit there, I wrote live for 10 years and I died. No one writes about themselves in such poor manner. They wish to glorify their own personal thing. No offense against Samuel. He's a great, wonderful judge. He did exactly what God inspired him, told him to do. However, in a time when he's writing this, David is not in control, but growing in popularity and control. He's from what tribe?
Judah.
What tribe was Joshua from? Ephraim. All right? So, and, oh, by the way, and also, who was David fighting against? Saul? What tribe is he from?
Benjamin.
These three main players that are showing up here in the first chapter alone. The book of Joshua, which was Ephraimites' tradition, meaning that they had most of the stories about him because that's where he lived, that's where he wrote, that was his dwelling place. They had access to him at the time which he was living. They had these stories of Joshua. Now, they're not all perfect, but they're basic core stories. So they have traditions of what happens to a given city, say, for example, Jerusalem, that Joshua took it, but Judah just couldn't handle it. That's what the book of Joshua says. Judah couldn't drive out the Jebusites. They were just too weak. Judah comes on the thing, says, we took Jerusalem. It was Benjamin's fault for letting it fall. They're pointing fingers. Not only that, throughout most of the book of Judges, Ephraim is looked down upon, saying, those incompetent, worthless people, look what they did. They had a civil war here. They were lazy. We didn't want to fight that. They didn't want to help Dan until the tail end when it was finally encroaching on their territory. They were lazy bums in the book of Judges. Joshua, however, look how wonderful Ephraim is. Look, they fought and they fought and they died and they went to battle and did all these wonderful things. Because we already, if you recall, we went through the campaign of Joshua, right? Guess what cities they all took? It's all in the territory of Ephraim primarily, and then down into Judah secondary, and as well as Benjamin caught in the middle. So all those territories of Ephraim that were recorded in Joshua are all glorious stories about how wonderful Joshua's campaign was. Why? Because he was Ephraim's hero. Judah doesn't have a hero, at least not at this point. In Judah's perspective, all those wonderful campaigns were terrible because Judah had to do all of them. The Ephraimites are just too darn lazy. We get that perspective the more chapters we read. We start realizing, wait a minute, this is heavy pro-Judah, the book of Judges is. While Joshua all along is in pro-all Israel as well as pro-Ephraimite. So we have the divisions that are showing up. 400-year difference in writers, that's going to happen. That's part of influence. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that God didn't inspire the book. I'm just saying, hey, human beings compiled it. That's what human beings do. That's our nature. If we were perfect, this wouldn't be an issue, but we're obviously not. And Samuel's not perfect. David's not perfect. Joshua's not perfect. All this stuff happens. So we have this thing that's happening. We have stories about God removing his protection back and forth. You know, this judge has to rise up and attack this town or that community. And we have a civil war that happens with Ephraim as well as with Benjamin. Both jabs from Judah's end. They don't like either party. Some of the judges will be greater or lesser. You have some judges that help inspire the whole nation. Most don't. Most inspire their individual tribes. Samson, for example. Who was he from?
Dan.
What tribe did he inspire to fight? Dan. Who was Jephthah? Jephthah, pronounced like Jephthah. What tribe was he from? Manasseh. Who did he inspire to fight? Manasseh. We have exceptions to those rules called Deborah, for example. Who does she inspire to fight? The whole nation. So you have variations in judges. Some inspire small areas and territories. Others inspire all nation together to fight. Jephthah, unfortunately, has a... Yeah, or at least half of them. Jephthah, unfortunately, has to deal with a civil war between Manasseh and Ephraim, which, again, it's just the nature of how the two books are written. Okay, so that was my little intro. So I should take care of this pretty quickly.
Fascinating.
All right. I think it is helpful. It has a general perspective as what's politically going on with the time when the books are being written. That influences everything in prophets as well as the writings, the history books. That changes perspectives. It changes what is accentuated. So-and-so's bad behavior is accentuated. Rather, this person over here's bad behavior is accentuated. When you go to the prophets, the major prophets, and they start ridiculing Judah and Israel, the northern southern kingdoms, some of those prophets focus on one or the other. Focus on what their bad behavior is, things that they've done badly, and they ignore the other one. Well, yeah, because that's what that prophet's job was. The judges and Joshua are no different. Their job is to focus on the things that you did wrong and what you can do to fix it in their own political spectrum, what's happening to them. Because that's what matters, right? If I tell you what you could do 3,000 years ago to fix your current situation, what good is that? Whoop-de-doo, great history lesson. However, if I can tell you a story that happened 3,000 years ago that is identical to what you currently are living through today and how you can actually influence your personal lives today and what your future is going to be, how valuable is that?
Very.
A lot more valuable. You actually have use and application for something. Well, the authors and prophets are no different. They're going to say, hey, look at this story back here and examine how does that story apply to you today. Hence, current political or political, physical, socioeconomic, any other region you think of that was happening at that moment in time and tried to make a relation, tried to connect it to people.
For our admonition.
Yes.
That's a possible goal.
Exactly. So, verse 1. The children of Israel inquired the Lord. How did they ask him? Joshua's gone. Moses is gone. How'd they ask? Anybody remember? What's the one tool they have? They can talk to God whenever they need to. The Urim and the Tumim. Right. The breastplate. The lights. A lot of speculation what the lights looked like. Most is commonly believed now that a light was actually it was a case, an encasing that had all the individual letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And each one or two letters would light up to spell out sentences or statements. It was the priest's job to figure out what those letters meant. They try to break them up into words, but that's how you would determine it. There are others who believe it. She didn't inquire all the letters, just required certain ones. I'm not going to go there anymore. I've dealt with that in the past. But either way, that was their method for communication, because God said he would no longer talk to anyone straight talking to them, except to Moses, and we found out later, to the Messiah. Everybody else is in dreams, visions, or in the priesthood's case, through the Urim and the Tumim. That's it. You want to ask him, that's the only way you can ask him. Otherwise, you're on your own, you follow his book, do the best you can, figure it out yourself. So, Judah, they all ask. This is a pro-Judah book. So, guess what? Judah gets to go up first. Why does it matter who goes up first? Yes, Tammy.
Set the example.
Yeah, set the example. What would that do to the rest of the tribes if Judah failed miserably?
They'll try something else.
If they had hope, they would try something else.
They would try something else.
But if they didn't have hope, it would dash theirs.
It would dash their spirit completely. They would no longer be, there wouldn't be fight left in them. So it actually is important who goes up first right after Joshua dies. Who's most, this is a key step in their life, in their history. No, by the way, I know Joshua comes back to life in chapter 2, but we're not going to go there in a minute. We'll deal with that tomorrow. Or, sorry, a couple weeks from now. Yeah, it says after Joshua's death. Well, Joshua, like I said, these books overlap a little bit. Joshua's still alive in chapter 2. Like, he technically doesn't die till the end of chapter 2 again. We'll cover that later as far as why. But at this point, Joshua's gone. Judah asks, or everybody asks who goes first. Judah goes forth. He brings Simeon, his brother. Now, I have this little map up here. My little E's in letters are the basic territories. They're not dead perfect. If you get a perfect map, you go online or something. I have Simeon's territory, little dotted dashed lines. I can move this little podium so people can see what I've written. Simeon's territory. Lost my little notebook. So you're right for moving the podium. All right, so Judah's territory is down at the bottom. He has at least half of what is considered modern-day Israel, right? Way more than Judah needs. It's an enormous territory. So as we already learned, Joshua, in the book of Joshua, Simeon took a certain number of cities in that territory. I have Simeon's territory dotted because there's not actually a defined line. He had individual regions or areas, but not an inheritance. Then we remember why. What the reason that Simeon and Levi both were not allowed to have territorial inheritance.
What happened during that whole scene.
That was one of the reasons, yes. That's part of it, yes. That's the groundwork. In Genesis chapter 49, Jacob prophesied, said, hey, Simeon and Levi, you are to be separate. You are no part of me. You are too violent together. Levi got scattered throughout the whole nation. Simeon had no permanent territory. Those of you curious as to Simeon, the tribe itself, when you look at the cities that they were given and the territories around after they took possession of that area, they are all very small nomadic towns. That's what Simeon was. They were semi-nomadic people. They traveled because they were shepherds, but they lived in an area that had very little to eat. They had small towns, unwalled, they were minimalist as far as the nature of the territories that they owned and possessed. So in Judah's case, they had big walled cities. Well, Simeon's case did not have any such thing. They were small, unwalled towns, easy to take, but easy to leave from and come back to later. They were very nomadic people. They were very violent, but they were nomadic people. So Judah and Simeon, they come and they take this whole territory. It's pro-Judah, pro-Simeon. Judah says, or says the book, they were unable to take the lowlands because of chariots, iron chariots and whatnot. So Judah was able to take the mountain range going all the way along here. They took the entire south. They took the coastland. What's the spot they couldn't take? Roughly in the middle. The lowland, the valleys, the area that was down low. Why? That has been stumping Jewish scholars and philosophers for like thousands of years. Why they could not take the lowland. I read four different independent theories as to why they couldn't do it. One of them I was able to throw out off the spot because it was pretty easy. But the other two, who knows? The valley, one of the reasons was sin. The belief that maybe Judah and Simeon were somehow just sinners, or they, while they were in the process of taking out, now it took some time, processing out the years of this campaign, they were just, something happened and they, God lost favor at the tail end when they could have taken the easiest part, which is the valley. Mountains are hard to take. Valleys are a whole lot easier to take when you're surrounded by mountains, because guess what? Everybody comes down from the mountains and they close in the valley. It's very simple. Not a whole lot of work involved. But they couldn't take that. That was one man's theory that was from sin. Another was, well, because the valley area is actually where Simeon's territory was, not Judah's territory. And the deal was that God was with Judah, not God with Simeon. So maybe that was a scenario, that somehow God would allow Judah to take all of their territory, but Simeon had to do it on their own. That theory was thrown out because Simeon didn't have the valleys, they had the south, which Judah already took. So that was an easy one. One was to test them. Maybe it was a theory to get the other cultures and people involved so that while the years go by, there would always be a trials. Another was lack of trust. Maybe they didn't trust God. Bottom line, chapter 2, says quite plainly, to be a thorn in your side. because you were not willing to do your job. That's what it actually says is the reason. Yes, Bill. Oh, I apologize. I just went through verse 19.
19?
Yeah. I shouldn't have gone that far ahead, but I did anyway. I already talked about the fact Jerusalem was attacked 4 different times, different people. A lot of theories about that. I'm not going to go through any of them. They're not that important. Bottom line, Jerusalem was not actually taken until David showed up 400 years later. That's when it was actually taken. Any time before that is partial or incomplete, at least. Either they took out cities or areas around it, couldn't hold it possibly, whatever the reason is, no one knows. One concept was that Judah was able to take half the city and they burned it because they couldn't grab the other half. This is because there was a fortress built in Jerusalem this time. A very strong fortress built in Jerusalem at this time. Difficult to take. They were unable to do it, so they just burned the city instead. They left the fortress intact, and everybody inside the fortress was still there. Hence, Judah blames Benjamin for not taking the fortress. Whatever. Not going to go there anymore. It was just funny to note that there's a lot of political strife going on, and it's going to get 10 times worse throughout this book. A lot of tribes bickering about how evil this tribe is compared to how righteous they are. What did we just read in the Torah today about Moses? The reason you're taking this area is not because of your righteousness. It's because the guys are just so much worse than you are. That's the bottom line. They're just really garbage trash, and you are just borderline above that. But there's a lot of strife between tribes arguing, hey, I'm stronger, I'm better, God likes me more, happening back and forth. Much like a family. You know, that's the way families work. Yeah, I appreciate it too. Yeah, it's the nature of human beings. We all do that. Well, I'm not so bad as you are in looking at somebody else. It's just the way everybody is. That's the way life is. And the tribes are no different. Yes, Kate.
I was gonna say, you see it even in politics. People go, well, I'm just voting it for the lesser of the two, yeah. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
They're both bad.
They're both bad, but which one's not quite as bad?
The lesser of the two.
Exactly. It's that's just the way life is. Benjamin, in verse 21, was unable to take, quote, their half of Jerusalem, or unable to drive out the inhabitants. Benjamin has their own issues with Civil War II later on. Yes, Richard.
I noticed that, you know, over here, when Judah took Jerusalem, doesn't mention the Jebusites, but over here it does.
Right.
Apparently the Jebusites are the ones that held that fort.
Yes, here. Yes, that's what it would appear. Now, that is strictly an argument from a Jewish man who likes the tribe of Judah who made the argument, blaming the tribe of Benjamin for the failure. Joshua took it and they blamed Judah for the failure. So, and no, I know Jerusalem was actually swapped hands a couple of times. Originally it was given to Judah, then it was taken and given to Benjamin. Some believe because Judah was unable to take Jerusalem, thus they don't deserve it. Benjamin was unable to take it also. Again, political bickering.
So it was given to the king 400 years later.
Yes, the king finally took it 400 years later. Okay, 22 to 26. I'm going to go past Judah because we'll deal with them as time goes on. I already talked about Caleb, by the way, when I was going through Joshua, because that's when it actually happened in the book of Joshua. The key to when you determine when something occurs is who has more detail. Who has more details?
What?
Book of Joshua has more details about Caleb's taking than the book of Judges does.
Right.
So it probably happened during Joshua's lifetime, not after he died. Most likely. And the detail is that Joshua points out that Caleb drove out these three individuals from the territory, and points out later that they moved to Gaza. The Gaza Strip, what we call Gaza Strip today. That's what Joshua's story says. Judges says, well, Caleb just killed them all. Or sorry, Judah just killed them all. It doesn't give details as to what actually happened. Caleb gives more details in the book of Joshua, thus it probably happened during the time of Joshua, not Judges. So we have everybody's being blamed. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanite, and they did not. Neither did Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali, Dan. The only kudos that Ephraim got, and verse 34, I'll go back to 22 and 26 in a minute. Verse 34 was that after Dan had been pushed up to the mountain range, which, draw up here a little bit, Dan's territory early on is this whole strip. So the mountain range is pushing up along this area, right along the border of Ephraim and Manasseh. After Dan's pushed up there, they can't come down to the valley area, which in this case is along the coastline. Ephraim finally said, okay, we'll push them out. They pushed them, didn't push them out. They just pushed them down a little bit. That's all. They didn't want to work too hard. It's not their territory, you know. It's a little bit of infighting happens. So that was the little kudos that they were given in this first chapter. One thing I do want to mention is one other point they did do with Bethel. Bethel is this little dot here between Benjamin and Ephraim. It's actually in Ephraim's territory. So remember, it says Bethel's original name was Luz. Does anybody know what Luz means?
Light.
Different language. What does Luz mean in Hebrew? Hazelnut. The hazelnut. You know, a little nut. You know what hazelnuts look like? They're completely encased in the shell, and the shell is pretty hard. There's no easy access to break the shell open, right? What was Luz's claim to fame? Their walls. Their walls were so high, and there was, key, no entrance to the city of Luz, or Bethel. There, by the way, Jacob renamed it to Bethel. It was Luz prior to him. There's no entrance. Well, how do you get into a town or a city when there's no door? And the walls are too high, you can't go over it.
Under it.
You see, Luz was happened to be situated just perfectly. The entrance was actually a cave. And it happened to be covered by, guess what? A hazelnut tree. Hence the name. When Ephraim and the house of Joseph, as it says, they show up and they don't know how to get in. They don't know where the cave is. They can't see it. How do they get in? So they find a passerby. Hey, how do you get in? Where's the entrance? Show us where the entrance is and we'll let you live. Which, I mean, you strike a deal. I'd say the guy took the better of the two options. He got the entrance. Once they know where the cave is, then they can come in and they took the town. It wasn't that hard to take. It wasn't that big of a town. But it happened to be located in such a way that there was only one way in, one way out, and it was hard to find. Hence the name Luz and why it was named that. Now, of course, the guy goes off and makes a town somewhere else, names the same thing. I doubt it was designed the same way, but that just happened to be the way this one. Yeah, memory, I guess. I don't know, whatever his reasons were. Yeah, so it's covered by haze and a tree. It is impossible to penetrate was the nature of it. And he had to find a cave to get in. That's the nature of that particular town. It was an interesting little story. And just funny that Jewish scholars argue that, well, yes, Joseph had to get their accomplishment, the one significant one, Bethel, the only thing they ever had to do, according to the Jewish commentary, was through deceit. As far as the Judah did it by brunt force. They talk about this a lot. The reason I bring this up, because a lot of commentaries discuss the differences between Joshua and Judges for this reason. That Joshua is heavily pro-Ephraimite, Judges is heavily pro-Judah and Simeonite, that there are going to be differences, and the differences started 400 years prior to any king ever showing up on the scene. So we can't blame the kings for doing something that God had established 400 years earlier. It was planned out that way. Hence why there's a division between the tribes. Yes, sir.
Well, think about that. You talk about a lot of the older one and then went this way.
You're right. Yeah.
And he later was called Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
It means the house of God.
You're right.
It's awful curious, like saying there's only one entrance way into the house of God.
That's a good perspective.
You've got to go through the side to get there. Otherwise, you don't get in.
Yeah, that's a good perspective. That's an interesting
that's
way of looking at it. Yeah.
I don't know
the truth. No, but it's a great simile, metaphorical. Yeah. I don't think I want to mention that just yet. I All right, I'll just briefly, Paul quits pretty early. Kenites are Jethro's descendants, who was the father-in-law of Moses. They never lived as an Israelite. They were not Israelites. They were Kenites. They always had their own separate lifestyle and livelihood of the Israelites, even though they were wandering with them for 40 years. So it points out the Kenites dwell with Judah down somewhere in this middle section. Jewish tradition places Kenites, Jabalites, and Simeonites all dwelt together. That's tradition. And the reason, because they all had the same job description. They were all semi-nomadic herdsmen. They never lived in city walls prior to Moses or after. So, since there are no towns that fit that description in all the territory of Judah, they figure they probably dwelt with Simeon down south. Easy place to live. They grew up and were born in this general area anyway. It's similar to what they're all accustomed to. That's probably where they lived. There's one other theory that said, well, they were just too righteous, so they must have studied under Othniel and studied the Torah for centuries because they just dedicated to the Torah. No, they were semi-nomadic herdsmen. It doesn't say they studied under anybody. They just went where there was space to live. And guess where they most likely lived, where the space was ideal, what they were accustomed to. Most likely the Simeon, within Judah's territory. Yes, Richard.
We went to Israel, the northern section of Israel. There's a certain tribe of people
that still wander.
Semi-nomadic ones, and that's their own territory, and they kind of wander all over the place, but you don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of parallel, knowing that it still exists.
Yeah, it's still, yeah.
Yeah, well,
3,000 years later.
Somebody else, there's still that tribe. Or people still kind of wander.
Still wander. And they're not completely nomads, because nomads have no territory. They are semi-nomadic. I mean, there's a designated area which they live, and they wander around. Nomads, they go wherever. Semi-nomadic is they're in a tight-knit area. Yes, Louise.
Simeon, violent, so was Levi. Simeon sort of thought bad of, but Levi has redeemed herself, and she has honored positions. What were the reasons? I have forgotten.
The selection of Moses and Aaron. Any other reason beyond that, you have to ask God. That's just strictly because of Moses, what Moses was willing to do and what Aaron was willing to do, thus Levi was selected.
Yeah. And even Aaron's son.
And Aaron's son. And that's it. That's the only reason they ever got redeemed from their father's curse. Simeon never got that.
Repent or stop a plague, or was Phineas or something.
That was afterward. After they were selected, all that happened.
Oh.
Prior to that, nothing of the sort occurred.
Because Levi was violent.
So was Simeon.
Yeah.
And nothing distinguished one or the other until the moment of when God selected Moses and Aaron. That distinguished Levi above Simeon. Okay. That's it. Okay. That is the distinction. I know most people tend to go to or gravitate toward an idea that, oh, well, because of this reason or something that this person did, thus they were rewarded because here.
Not because of their uprightness.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, their uprightness didn't do it. They didn't do anything good or bad. Well, they did it bad. Anything good to deserve anything. They were just selected. God could have chosen Judah. He could have chosen Ephraim. He could have chosen Issachar, anybody for that matter, but he didn't. He could have chosen Simeon. Okay. He chose Levi instead.
Wow. All right.
His reasons, you got to ask him. I don't have the answer. The Bible doesn't tell us the answer. Okay. That's it. Are there any questions? Comments? Other than the little Adonai Bezek's little thumb and toe episode? That's kind of funny, huh? I read that. I was like, what? How gory? But, you know, that's kind of how it works. Yes,
yeah,
Tammy.
If you think about your hands for a second, you know, you take away someone's thumbs, you can't hold a pencil.
You can't do much. Yeah, a lot of things you lose.
A lot of things you lose. And
can't hitchhike.
When I was
and your big toe is for balance.
Yeah, yeah. Because I didn't
run. Hard to walk, hard to stand.
Without your big toe, there were stories of boys that didn't want to go to Vietnam. They tried to shoot off their
right.
big toe.
Right.
But unless you shoot off that joint there at the very bottom, you know, you can still have your balance. But if you destroy that final joint there that's closest to the foot itself,
mm-hmm.
then even your balance. So you are, in a very small way, it seems very small. Your thumb and your big toe seem pretty small. It isn't like locking up an entire arm or an entire hand. But you have effectively crippled them with a minimum amount of effort.
Right, right.
Really.
It is a tradition that actually Rome took up. The Roman soldiers did the same thing. Not that many of us actually care about that much history, but just in case you did. The Roman citizens, if they opted not to go to the military, mind you, all males, Roman citizens, would go to the military unless you happen to be of a wealthy family.
Right.
That's it. There is no option. There's no, well, it's not a volunteer army. Well, of course, yeah, it's a requirement. That's what you do. If you choose not to, you cut off your thumbs and your toes, then the army doesn't need you or doesn't want you. You can stay in Rome or in the territory and be happy and content. It's been around a long time. Right or wrong, it's still been around a long time. It's kind of gory in some ways. Adonai Bezek got what he did, received what he dished out. Nothing really impressive there. Judah is the only one recorded ever doing anything like this to someone who has done something evil. Saul has the opportunity to do so, but he doesn't. There was a guy he goes up against, I believe he was from the tribe of Ammonite or whatever. King there, he plucks out the right eye of people he doesn't like, and he does it to a portion of one of the Israelite tribes. I don't recall which one off the top of my head. The males, takes their right eye out. Because you can't fight if you're missing an eye. It's really difficult to fight against because you have a blind side, obviously. Saul has the opportunity to do this as well. He opts not to. He just goes to battle. He wins the battle, but anyway. It also happened to take place at Bezek, by the way. Bezek means lightning in Hebrew. If you go on the internet and look for Bezek, you'll find this lightning internet connection, but it's kind of funny. No one knows where in the world that was. No clue where Bezek is, where Adonai Bezek went, what happened to him, other than the fact he's supposed to die in Jerusalem. One guy said it was probably Adonai Bezek, is probably the same guy as Adonai Zedek, the guy written in, he's the king of Jerusalem, that Joshua took out. Difference between Ephraim and Judah. I don't like you, thus I will take or do your job for you. It's Judah's perspective. No one knows for sure, though. In which case, Adonai Bezek or Zedek would be right here at the border between Jerusalem and Benjamin. But no one knows. I don't have any other comments, at least not in this chapter. Chapter 2 is going to be kind of fun because we get to talk to an angel of God again. Woohoo! Any other comments or questions you have? Yes, Louise.
Comments. So interesting. Whatever is going on politically in the world today, I'm never going to be able to unscramble it or unsnarl it. Well, we can't unscramble this or unsnarl this only until Jesus comes back. And God chose to shine his light through this. He could have done it many, many, many other ways. He just decided to do it through this.
Very true.
Snarl.
It is a snarling mess. There are other comments? We're going to call it quits. Oh, yes, Tammy.
I was just thinking, I kind of cheated and read through here a little bit further, but Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother.
Right.
But what I find interesting in this little story here is that Othniel is brave enough to, you know, take this city, and he does it they seem to play almost single-handedly, gets the girl. And then he isn't brave enough to go back to his father-in-law and say, hey, can you give me this? Has his wife do it.
Yeah. Yep, I know. Everybody has their character flaw. No, Judaism pegs on them.
He's the one.
Yeah, right after Joshua dies. Yeah.
Right after Joshua
dies. Judaism, they get him on that one too. It's like, you were right there, often. You had the opportunity to show how strong of a person you were. And you did all this wonderful battle that you took care of this town, and then you can't handle talking to Caleb yourself. They pay him on that. It's like, You had your opportunity to be strong, but you didn't. I can't comment beyond that. Othniel does some good things later on, I think in a chapter or two from now. He actually does some battle. He leads a battle. Very strong individual. Keep in mind, throughout the whole book of Judges, there's one thing that you don't ever lose sight of. The number of years of good things and tranquility and happiness are vastly more than the number of years of dread and misery. Always keep that in perspective. Like, for example, Othniel, he takes over like 40 years of happiness and nothing happens. And the next guy, 20 years of this, of happiness, and then 10 years of bad things. The next one, 100 years of this, and then 20 years of bad, something bad happens to them. It's huge on the pro, you know, life is good side compared to the life's not so good side. That contributes a lot to communal amnesia. The people forget what they're doing and why they're doing it because they have almost a generation passes before something bad happens again. We'll discuss that in a couple weeks though. Thank you for your time.